our credentials.
Yeah.
But it exists out there.
Yeah.
And it's
No.
Okay, you guys, I just want to welcome everybody for our November meeting, those that are here in person, and welcoming those that are visiting us through Zoom. I appreciate that. And I just want to just, again, welcome everybody, and then just to remind everybody that there will be given opportunity during the meeting to clarify or ask questions as we go. Those of you that are visiting electronically, please raise your hand. We'll be following. Raise that little hand, and we'll do our, make sure we get to you and get your questions and comments answered. So we're just going to kind of move on with our agenda. We have full quorum, so that works out really well. So, so first, we do have a new advisory committee member, Christy Cole. She's visiting us through Zoom. She's taking the place of Tania Tom, our public at large person. And Christy, if you're able, I would love it if you could just take a minute or two and introduce yourself.
Of course. My name is Christy Cole. I'm currently a social service worker with the Paiute Indian Tribe of Utah, located in Cedar City. I just started working here in August, so everything's new to me. So I'm eager to meet you guys and have you guys teach me a few things about this program. But before I moved here to Cedar, I was in Las Vegas, where I worked at Family Services in Clark County, Nevada. And, yeah, I'm excited to be here.
Great. Welcome. And then just for a minute purposes and stuff, I do want to note that Brian Zabriskie is here for Johnny Anderson. So. And moving right along, hopefully we had a chance to look over the minutes that were sent out. And if you've had time to do that and everything, I'd love to get a motion to accept those.
Second.
I think that was Elizabeth.
Second.
Is there any... correction? Did anybody, any discussion or anything that you want to take place in those minutes? No? So all in favor with an aye?
Aye.
Aye. Or raise hand? Any opposed? Same matter. Okay, wonderful. Looks like we've adopted those minutes. Right, so we're just going to move on. As always, our agendas do seem to be kind of full. We just want to make sure we're taking good care of the time. So I'm just going to move it over to Rebecca.
Our smaller sheet.
I'm in. Sorry. It's like that waitress that comes.
So I think most of our group knows, but if you don't, we have Nuna is going to be leaving OCC, and she's been hired as the Office of Early Childhood Director for the Department of Health and Human Services. These are her final few hours here with OCC. But you guys may not know that Montana is also going to be leaving OCC tomorrow, and she's going to the Department of Health and Human Services as well.
I have nothing to do with it.
I am in the process of filling those positions, but I just want to let you guys know, and I mean, Montana has been the backbone of this advisory group, and so I want to make sure that we recognize them and said thank you, and please check on me Monday. Thank you. So I just want to let you guys know about that change.
Montana, you've been great.
Thank you. It's a huge loss for us, but it's good opportunity for them and for others to join our team, so it'll be great. The next thing I wanted to talk about is the electronic attendance system. If you guys recall, a year ago, we talked about an electronic attendance system that Office of Child Care was under contract with. It was being built. And at that time, we had anticipated that that was going to be something that we were going to make mandatory of all child care providers that received a subsidy. We got a lot of feedback. We heard the feedback, and we are going to make some changes. What we are looking at doing is, if you recall, the reason why we had entered into a contract and we were looking at an electronic attendance system was due to some internal audit and some evaluations that we received about just the ability to manipulate and change attendance records. And so what we would like to do, what we're starting to plan on, is that July 1st, this policy would be in place that we will be requiring an electronic system to be used by providers that are receiving a subsidy, but they can use their own. We understand that a lot of providers have a really sophisticated case management systems that are attached to billing and to scheduling and other things. And so what we would like is that the requirement will be that everyone has an electronic system. If you don't have your own, you are welcome to use ours, and we will help provide that, but ours will not be mandatory. We will look and see after July 1st, we'll look and see how does it look, has it been effective, and we'll use that to talk about what future policy and what future implementation might look like. But that's the changes that we've made, and so I wanted to let you guys know. I wanted to let you guys know now, one, to anticipate coming up in July, so in a few months, but also we are going to be reaching out and asking for some providers to be early implementers because we would like their experience to help us gain, to be able to help us design our training and some of the support that may be needed. And so I wanted to let this group to know and be aware of that. Any questions about that change?
I have a comment.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Because it would just be double the work for us, so I really appreciate that. We do have our systems in place, and a lot of centers do have electronic system in place.
Yeah.
So thank you.
You're welcome. All right. Would you like me to just go to my next slide?
Please.
All right.
I can introduce you again.
Maybe I should just do all of mine like at once. I don't mind it to each item. But I do wanted to provide, this is our agenda item about our COVID relief funding update. A couple of things I wanted to provide information on. Our early youth and early care workforce bonus, that program has come to an end, and I just wanted to give you a final summary. If you'll go to the next slide, sorry. We had, as reported last time, just under 9,900 applications that we received from July 19th to August 30th. And in that time, this isn't that the slides we changed.
Let's take the old version.
So I'll just do it from my memory. So we approved about 9,300 applications. And we were able to, that totaled about $18.7 million that went out into the workforce between basically August 1st through the end of September. And so we wanted to be able to provide that update for you. Anecdotally, we heard that providers really appreciated that it helped with some onboarding and hiring some staff, gearing up for the school year. And so we were happy that we were able to do that. If you guys recall, we included a bunch of demographic information. We thought this would be a perfect opportunity to survey almost 10,000 individuals. And so we have gathered some data. It's a lot of data that was gathered that we have to now sort through and sift through, and we're going to be asking for some help on that. But just to let you guys know, a couple of points of interest. The most common age group of our workforce, I don't know if this is a surprise, it's between 18 and 24. And the most common wage category was $15 to $16 an hour. This was interesting for me. We've talked about, you know, historically the average wage in Utah for childcare workers has been about $10 to $12. With our stabilization, there was some incentive, an additional enhanced payment to bring wages up to $15 an hour. And I think that has been successful in the moment as seen through this, indicated in the survey. The other thing I want to talk about is just the highest education level. It was really a close tie between a high school diploma or equivalent and some college with no degree. This is, like I said, these are just three data points. We asked about almost 20 questions and gained some really good information, but we have to sort through that. We'll give you more. So this is just a little hint, a little teaser for next time. The next thing I wanted to talk to you about... But with our ARPA discretionary plan, as you guys know, or if, in case you don't know, when we talk about our COVID relief funding was made up of several funding sources, some of which had to be obligated by September or October 1st of this year and have to be expended by September 30th of 2023. There was one funding source that extends an additional year, and that's the ARPA discretionary funding. That funding has to be obligated by September 2023 and spent by September of 2024. One of the things that we talked about and we've communicated is that some of the programs that we started with our COVID relief, we started with our HRSA funding, the funds that expired sooner, and then we wanted to look and see from those programs, what do we want to expand into an additional year with ARPA discretionary. And so we've been pulling some information, and I'd like to share with you what our plan, what we're anticipating. You can see on the column on the left our programs that we would like to continue, maybe not at the same funding levels because there's less of the ARPA discretionary funding than the others, but we anticipate continuing to pay the licensing fees and background check fees with Department of Health and Human Services. Our ASQ developmental screening project is funded through the ARPA discretionary. We've provided funding for the therapeutic preschool with the Children's Center. I want to come to the stabilization grant in just a minute. We've had regional grants to our Care About Child Care agencies, and we've looked and they've asked for some additional funding to extend some of those supports out an additional year, which we were excited about. Professional development, some of the scholarships we have in place, extending that for another year. The stabilization grant, both funded by the stabilization funds and the HRSA funds. If you remember, we have two grants really running that look exactly the same but funded differently. What we would like to do is, after we anticipated and estimated what we would spend on all the programs, all of our remaining ARPA discretionary funds would be used to extend the stabilization grants past next September. We believe that we can do extend those out for up to 9 months, but at a reduced rate. And so what that could look like is, for the first 6 months, it could be 50% of what your current grant is, and then for the next 3 months, it could be a smaller percentage of that. That is the model that we want to do. I don't know what the exact funding amounts will be because we needed to finalize some of the other estimates to know what was available. But that is our plan.
Did you say from the October or September of 2024?
It will go. Right now they're scheduled to end September 30th of 2023.
Okay.
So then this will extend it into past that time.
Okay.
New programs that we are looking at funding with our ARPA discretionary. We're going to talk a little bit later today about our infant toddler material grants. We want to translate our material, all of our materials, our training materials, into Spanish, and so using some funds to be able to do that. We are looking at doing some childcare supports for customers, DWS customers that are in a DWS-sponsored training program, and being able to provide child care for those individuals. And then with the mental health contracts, we have contracted funding with Department of Health and Human Services. And I'm happy to announce those contracts have just been executed. And so you'll providers will be receiving information about two mental health supports specifically for providers. One will be a referral and help to get services from local mental health authorities, and the other will be to be able to participate in like an employee assistance program that will be available. So that is going to, those were just signed, that will be communicated out shortly. That is our, that's our plan with the ARPA discretionary. I'd love for feedback from this group or ask or entertain any questions.
I have a question about subsidy.
Yeah.
Does that play in here? Are you going to tear that down for clients or for customers, or are you going to just cut it?
For the, what do you mean the subsidy?
So paying their copay.
Oh, okay. That's a really good question. Copayments is one thing that we've been paying for with our CRSA funds. We will need to go back and we will be requiring copayments again. That will be sooner than later because of the application periods. So that those changes will happen shortly. We'll be announcing that in the coming.
So will it be a full copay that they're going to go back to the old one, or are they going to tear it? Are you going to tear it and drop them down?
We're trying to figure that out.
Okay.
We're trying to figure out what we can afford with our CCDF funding, our ongoing funding.
So just for word of advice,
please.
Parents have gotten used to that. So now if you tell them that they now have to pay for the full thing, you're going to see a huge decrease, and you're going to probably see them go out of high quality and into possibly some situation that could be not relatively safe.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to say dangerous, because that's a severe word, but possibly something that we don't want them to go through, because the copays, you know, can be anywhere between $50 to $300.
Mm-hmm.
And then if a center charges more, then they're going to pay that $300, plus they have to pay
the
another $300. Yeah. And so that's going to be a big chunk for them at first.
Yeah.
And so I would recommend doing something where you do it like the 9 months, 50%, you know, something like that that you're doing on the stabilization grant. It's really important.
Okay. Thank you.
And are you going to keep the, you know, you increase the level of subsidy?
That will remain.
Mm-hmm.
You'll keep that. Anyway.
Yeah, we'll keep that at the 85%.
Okay.
Yeah. That is, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Any other questions, comments? General support for this plan?
Go back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Anything? Okay. All right. I'll go on to the next item. The next thing I wanted to talk about was the employer startup grants. If you recall, we, part of the legislative session, asked us to use some of our COVID relief funding for employer startup grants, where we would provide grants to child care providers that contract with an employer providing near or on-site child care for their employees. We issued an RFP for a nonprofit organization to oversee and facilitate that program, and that was awarded to Children's Services Society. That contract was just executed, and so they are going to be developing and designing and rolling out that program. That program is, we've obligated $5 million of the ARPA discretionary funds to support that program. And so that is coming, and I think that will be, we've asked them to really market with employers this opportunity and then working with child care providers to fill that need. So I'm really excited about that. Any questions about the employer startup?
I think the Children's Services are starting to ramp up on that by going into centers and doing some modeling with them. So, you know, I think that that's what they're trying to do, to
Great.
Get ramped up to go that direction.
Great.
From what I've heard.
Thank you. Yeah. Okay. The next slide was the mental health grants. I stole my own thunder. I told you about those just a second ago. So those are, I believe those are all the items that I wanted to share as far as the COVID, our COVID funding updates.
Okay, if we don't have any questions or... Okay, great. So we're just going to move right on to our Care About Chautauqua regional highlights. And we have Carolyn with the Metro region. So we're going to turn the time over to you, Carolyn.
Good afternoon, everyone. I hope you're staying warm.
because the storm is blowing in as we speak. I just wanted to update you a little bit on our progress with our CURSA funding that we received. Just to kind of recap, we provide services to Salt Lake and Tooele counties, and our project staff is myself, Daniel Cruz, and Amanda Bolden, and they are working in the capacity of coordinating and coaching and working with the centers that we are providing services to. Next slide. So just as a review, the top bullet was our overarching goal for this project, and it's about creating or increasing the quality of programs and provide tools to help them be more sustainable in the future, and also providing some support on how to have healthy workforce and focusing a lot on low-income DWS-subsidized programs. And for this year, we've added some supports in place for providing startup funds to become fully licensed. And that means that we're working with current RC programs and FFNs to become fully licensed or seeking out people who would like to start a child care center or family child care. So we've been marketing and doing a lot of outreach in that area just in these last few short months. Next slide. I've just pulled this data a couple weeks ago, and I found it kind of interesting. I don't know how much of an effect my program had on this, but it's kind of interesting to see the growth that's happened in the last year and a half. You can see May 2021, which was about a year into COVID, what the numbers were and what they are just this November. So I can only speculate that people are coming back to the workforce. Our subsidies and funding that's out there is helping people reopen or start new programs. So I just thought this was interesting information to share. Any questions or comments about that, or what maybe you think the reason why these things are happening? I think it's great progress. And that's just information taken from the Care About Child Care website. So those are active programs.
Carolyn, can I have a question?
Yeah.
Are these active programs in the Salt Lake and Tooele area, or was this a statewide?
This is just Salt Lake and Tooele.
Okay.
I find it really interesting, the licensed family child care growth. So kudos to everybody who's out there working and helping these programs get up and running.
Carolyn?
Yes.
I have a guess, just thinking out loud, which is a horrible idea. But for licensed family child care programs, it's not uncommon to talk, even pre-COVID, to folks who opened family child care programs because they could not find a quality child care program and decided to just have one in their home to generate income for their household. With the number of women who have left the workforce during COVID because of child care, I wonder if this is just like a plausible second income for families who can't afford child care. Ironically, I would guess that most of those would be run by women, though not exclusively, but I could see that maybe there are people who just aren't going back into the traditional workforce because they can't afford to have a job outside of the home and pay for child care with that salary.
Yeah, I would have to agree. That makes a lot of sense. My daughter-in-law is kind of doing the same thing in another state. It's just easier to tend to her own children and the neighborhood kids at the same time. So, yeah, I just thought it was an interesting piece of data to share with you. Okay, next slide.
Who was that? Just one second, Carol.
Simone has his hand.
Okay.
Simone has his hand up.
Yes, Simone.
Sorry, I didn't want to bother so much, but...
Oh, you're fine.
To add to what Anna was saying, we also open up the possibilities for home providers who have experience with childcare to open a secondary facility, and that has helped throughout the state as well.
Thank you for that.
And then Tina has, yes, I've often thought we should encourage those special needs parents who cannot work out of the home to open up specialized child care. Great.
And Leah, in her region, has done a fantastic job of creating her All Means All program. So kudos to Leah for thinking about those special needs children with special needs and their families and what their needs are. All right, so here's a look at some achievements and some of our outcomes. I had a lot of fun running these numbers. We started out with 20 programs, the first cohort. Four programs had to drop out for personal reasons. So we ended up with 16 for this first cohort. Over 900 hours of coaching was provided. These are typically one-hour weekly meetings with all of our providers that we work with. Some only require 15 minutes, some require an hour and a half. It's a lot of the conversations are based on mental health and just having someone to talk to, which is awesome for my coaches to be able to provide that personal conversations. Over 900 hours of professional development was completed, and they did this in a lot of different ways. They took career ladder courses. We got them all enrolled in Quorum e-learning, so they have access to professional development on their own time. And many took the ERS best practice courses. So that was one of our goals, was to grow that professional development. $32,000 in incentives were given. Participants earned this incentive for participating and achieving their goals. And I believe that this number is low. I think we've had more purchases than this, but I'm just going off the data from last fiscal. $31,000 in program materials were purchased, and we were able to provide lots of things that were connected with security and safety and outdoor play environments. Programs are really interested in updating their outside play areas and making sure that they had a security system in place. And curriculum was also one of those things that they were really interested in purchasing and learning about. Next slide. So here's some of the outcomes I thought were interesting. 11 programs are participating in the CCQS, with 4 of those being new applicants, 8 centers, and 4 family child care. And then provider and program goals. These were goals that were set and met by our programs. Unfortunately, I don't have the hard number data. A lot of outcomes are anecdotal, so we need to go through all of our anecdotal records and kind of give them a score to figure out the percentages. But they wanted to increase their rating scales, their ratings, and their scores, and they did. Many programs implemented new curriculum. We were able to connect them with the Children's Center for emotional support for children and teachers. They were able to increase their rates and enrollment. They've been working really hard at building staff morale and team building, and the outcome for that was less staff turnover, which is great. And then we were able to meet their safety goals for some of the goals that they set. Next slide. Yes, so our plans for 2023, we've started work with our new cohort. We had 70 applicants, and last year we only had 40, or only, I shouldn't say only. We really want to be able to provide services to all of the people that applied, but we're only a three-person group, and it's hard to provide that kind of coaching and mentoring to all 70. 10 center base and 10 family child care. And then our startup grants, the intention is to provide assistance to programs and individuals to help them overcome the barriers of becoming licensed, startup assistance for new programs, and assist RCs and FFNs to become fully licensed. And I'm exhausted just looking at all the work we did and all the work we have coming forward. Part of this, we're sending out a survey next week, and we've been attending lots of outreach activities, giving out flyers. We had a resource and education night where we had 10 providers come, and we gave them information and have followed up with them about becoming licensed. Most of those folks were RCs and FFNs. So we're looking forward to working with them and getting them going on becoming fully licensed. Any questions?
No, just good work.
Yay.
Yeah, thank you for your time today. And if anybody has any questions or knows of people that would like to be fully licensed, send them my way. And we'll get them hooked up with the people that are doing the amazing work to help these people be fully licensed. Thank you.
Thank you, Carolyn. It's great. Yeah, that's a lot of work. I look forward to hearing the updates from the Care About Child people around the state. It's great. So we're just going to go ahead and move right on to our OCC updates. And, Joellen, it looks like you're first.
Am I? I'm first?
You're first.
Wow. Hi, everybody. I missed last month's meeting. I have to go to another meeting, so it's really, I'm really happy to be with you again. I am going to talk about the Infant Toddler Support Incentive. Kim Melville and I have been working. I think we've been living together. That's what I do every time I have a new project with one of my staff. I live with that person on the computer while we figure everything out. We've been working on this a lot. We have the structure ready. As is always, when we do a new initiative, the devil is in the details. And so I'm going to talk about it. It's going to sound really simple and easy, and it is compared to a lot of other things we do, but we're still figuring out. We're still going to need to operationalize it. So here is where we're at. You know we're using ARPA discretionary funding for now to fund this. For programs, it will be for programs that go through the rating process and finish entirely and are given a certified foundation or quality or building quality rating. Programs that are rated on or before January 1st of 2023 will be able to apply. So what that translates into, anybody that is having observations this month will be able to apply because their ratings will go into effect January 1st. Incentives, the incentive amount is determined by the number of slots in each room that is operating. So it's a little bit different depending on the size of the room. And we also have had to manage how to deal with the classrooms that are 2-3 mixes. We have a lot of those in Utah where they're together, half the kids are 2, half the kids are 3. So we've figured that out, we do believe. The family child care amount is determined by the number of children using under the age of 3 enrolled in the program. So they're mixed age groups, so that is an interesting formula that we use to figure out their amount as well, because we kind of had to do a hybrid amount, right, between if you look at in a 2-year-old program and how many kids are in a room,
And then how many babies are in a room, those are different numbers, right? So infant rooms are more expensive to equip, a lot more expensive. The 4-to-1 ratio makes them a lot more expensive to run. So it's more for a child in an infant room than it is in a twos room. Well, family child care, they got everybody together. So we ended up with a hybrid amount that's between those two, if that makes sense. So the way we'll determine the actual amount of support will be based on the data that's gathered at initial visits when the specialists are actually out in the programs. So whenever they go out in the programs, including family child care, they find out and they record for us, you know, how many rooms are open and operating, what the ages of the rooms are, of the kids in the room, how many, if it's a twos, threes room, how many of the kids are two, how many of the kids are three. If it's family child care, we know that too. So we felt it was easier for us to take data that we had just gathered a couple months before than having to put the burden on the provider to turn in additional paperwork to prove how many kids. So what we really tried to do with this was take one, build it into a system we're already running so we could get it up quickly, and also to decrease the burden all around. So a lot of the stuff we're doing, we're already doing anyway. We're just going to use that information. But we also have set it up to decrease the burden for programs and how much time it will take them. Next slide.
Can I ask a quick question, Carolyn?
Yes. I'm Joellen.
But Joellen. I was looking at Carolyn's name. Sorry.
Yeah, you bet.
Having a bit of a winter brain on set. So the overarching goal of this particular program is that by giving child care providers an extra incentive for every infant and toddler slot they have, we'll have more available in the state?
Of course, one of the things we worry about all the time mm-hmm. at the Office of Child Care is infant toddler care.
Of course.
So hopefully any kind of you know, funds that people can get for taking children that age,
mm-hmm.
You know, our hope is to always be able to help people retain. But I think what we are, the goal of this particular thing has to do with when our group discussed with all of you last year, and we were talking about the challenges of infant toddler mm-hmm. care. And just because of that 4-to-1 ratio, or even an 8-to-1 ratio in a twos room, that's still a lot less than the preschoolers, right? And how could we find ways to infuse funds into those programs to help them be able to maintain them? So I think a lot of this is our goal. We don't want to lose slots.
Okay.
We want to keep slots. We also want to help as much as we can with that cost. It's expensive.
Yeah.
It is very expensive. And, you know, things break.
Yeah.
You know, if you buy really high quality furniture, a lot of it will last for years and years. But toys break. They wear out. Books. I used to joke when I was a center owner, after I would buy board books and bring them into the infant toddler rooms, and I'd say to my staff, I got some more teethers for you, because that was one of those things that was constantly, because they do, they chew on them, and they look at them, and they're really hard on them. So, I think more than anything, it's just support to help people maintain.
So we don't lose those slots. That totally makes sense. I think everyone kind of gets the imperative around infant or toddler care. Is the idea eventually to continue this and cover it with ongoing funding?
Part of the reason we set it up the way we did and the financial structure in the way we did is that there's a possibility we could.
Okay.
When COVID is over, we have to look. I mean, we've initiated so many things, but if we were to bring up a giant program that cost a ton of money, took us a year to bring it up, implement for a year, and have to tear it down, it doesn't make a lot of sense, right? So this is something that we could possibly, but I can't commit to that at this time.
I think, if I could add, just to what Joellen said, there's so many things we've put in. We can't
fund all of them ongoing. And so we are going to have this reality of more finite funds again. And so we'll have to decide, what did we learn from doing some of these things? Was it effective? Did we maintain slots? Is this where we want to use some of our money, funding, knowing that something else would have to give?
No, that totally makes sense. And I think, Rebecca, you were in the same Women in the Economy Commission meeting that I was in, where one of our legislators remarked, like, what cliff effect are you talking about? This isn't money that you had before, and then you're not going to have it, and everything's going to be fine. There is, like, a foundational misunderstanding among state policymakers about how the child care sector works, especially around in-the-weeds stuff like this, about how much everything costs, but then how much more it costs for infant and toddler. And I think we can all agree that increasing ratios for infants and toddlers is not an answer. And that kind of deregulation is like the easy default that our legislators go to. So I just bring that up because, I mean, I'm obsessed with all of these great programs that I think probably should have always existed, that our state policymakers, well, we have to help them understand that they're not like a special bonus for COVID. It's like, no, basically this is what we've always needed and we finally have money for it. And if we don't do it anymore, things are just going to be harder for everybody who needs childcare.
And for children. I mean, that's my thing.
That is the big thing at the end of the day.
It's harder for children.
It's harder for children.
Yeah.
I have a question. But it seems to be that this is going to be tied to the CCQF.
It is
tied to CCQF. So is that the direction that we're going with in the state, is pretty much like a forced entry into the CCQF? Is that direction that we're going? It was meant to be a not mandatory program, but if you want to have additional funding, then it's going to be mandatory pretty much. That's pretty much where we're going.
I think that the challenge with, like, when you're talking about something that we have to get out, we tied it to something we already have. It's not our goal to force people
to
participate.
But if they want this, they're pretty much forced to do it.
To get a certified rating for the program?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, and I think that is how the state is running. They're pushing more and more towards the CCQS program. I think there's some major flaws in that CCQS program that it needs to be investigated more. Because when you look at the state, 0.03% of centers were participating with CCQS. That is a terrible number. We need to increase that, but it's nearly impossible to get on it. So it's something that needs to be, and if we're tying something like this to that, we're not increasing the quality, we're just increasing and making it more mandatory. So I just think it's something interesting that we need to look at in our state.
Okay. We have more than a 0.03 participation.
So in the Salt Lake. That was in the Salt Lake from these numbers that she pulled.
I don't know.
That was from her.
That's from her.
Yeah, I was like looking at that. I'm like, oh gosh.
No, that's not CCQS. That's her program.
I mean, Joel, if I may. I mean, we do want more people to participate in CCQS. So as an office, we are going to be looking for ways to incentivize people to engage and participate in that. And so what you're saying is true.
I think we need to look at that. It's not going where I think we thought it was going to go when we were all on those committees to develop it. Mm-hmm. Just think that we need to look at that.
That's my response, Alan. So here's how it will work. This is really where the devil lives. Right? I talked about the devil being in the details. And it sounds super simple. We're getting it. We're going to meet our deadline, but this is how it will work. So each month when programs are rated, OCC, we will do this in partnership with URPD. They are great partners in so many things with us. So we'll provide a list and eligible amount to URPD each month after a program has been rated. So they'll know who to notify. Hey, by the way, you're eligible for some funds if you would like them. So they'll send out an email letting programs know of the opportunity and extend an application to them. So the link to the application will be right in the body of the email. If you'd like to apply for this, click here. Super simple. Basically, it's just saying, I'm this program. Here's my contact information. Yes, I want to participate in this program. So after the application is received, URPD sends the materials needed to apply. So the program receives the instructions and all forms that they need to complete. And really what it boils down to is there's a classroom inventory for each room that qualifies that they will need to not inventory their whole room. They'll just need to inventory the areas where they want stuff. So, like, if they want to focus on their block area, they would tell us what they have in their block area and how much they want to buy to get a full block space or whatever. So, they would do the classroom inventory. One thing that is different, usually when we have these kind of grants, we limit it to stuff that's going to last. This time we are giving a 25% allowance. One of the really expensive things about care for kids that are diapered is the ridiculous amount of consumable things you buy. I used to joke when I had my center that I should just buy stock and Kleenex and paper towels and I would be rich, right? Because I bought so much of that myself for my program. So they will have a list. There will be, and they can also buy art supplies. Crayons that are age appropriate for kids under three. So they can take 25% of their funds if they like and spend them on specific consumable items. And it'll be based on the need that the program demonstrates when they submit their equipment and materials list, their inventory. Sorry, I think I should have written that differently. So they take their inventory, they get to choose what they want to purchase. URPD will give them all the information about that. They'll create their list. They'll submit their list into us. They'll be reviewed. The materials have to meet certain specifications. They have to be age appropriate. They have to be purchased from an early childhood vendor, and so on and so forth. So they'll have all those guidelines. Once the list is approved, then URPD orders all the stuff on the list and has it sent directly to them. So they don't have to enter into a contract. The beauty of this that I love, because it's a nightmare for me, we don't have to enter into any contracts for people. No contracts. Everybody that meets this criteria is eligible. And they don't have to deal with collecting receipts and getting them into us by a deadline. That is a big challenge for providers. So they'll send their list. They'll also have, at the bottom of the list, they'll have alternate items. So that, let's say something is no longer available. So they'll know that we're going to prioritize everything that's approved on their list. They're definitely going to want to stick with the rules of the grant. So they're not going to buy preschool-sized shelves, for example. If they do, we're not sending them that, right? So they're going to want to stick with their list. But if there's something on the list that's no longer available or it's not age appropriate and so it's crossed off their list, we'll go to their alternate list. It's going to be like Christmas, and then they're going to open their normal day and there's going to be Mr. UPS guy or whoever dropping off a bunch of boxes for them.
And this does mentoring too, right? There will be mentoring in this program?
If the program needs it, yes. But not... It isn't set up that different programs need such a different level
they
of
do.
Support.
They do. Yeah.
We have a lot of programs. I've been on our grants before that already know. They would know what to do, and they would be able to complete the stuff in 2 days. And I mean, not even take whole 2 days,
yeah.
But you know what I mean.
Yeah, awesome.
We might have other programs with questions. If they need support, then they can get it. Mostly, though, it won't be in-person support. It would be like over-the-phone support. But, yeah. So there it is, folks. Sounds simple, and it is relatively simple. But we're getting there. We're getting there. Any questions?
Are they able to choose from any vendor?
They can't choose. Okay, so URPD has a list of many vendors. There's certain things. First of all, they do have to specialize in equipment made for group care. So they we don't buy from everybody under the sun. URPD has to be able to set up an account with that group so that the group will take their money. So the provider will get quite a lengthy list, but they will only be able to choose three vendors. Because once you start ordering, it just gets way. So they'll be able to choose three early childhood vendors, and then they'll be able to choose a vendor for disposable, for the like paper towel, glove, you know, that kind of thing, if they want to get some of that consumable item. So.
And do you know how or where the money is lying per student on this grant? Or?
It is. In centers, it is, it kind of depends on the circumstance. So if it's an infant room, we have some infant rooms that only hold four. We have some that hold between six and eight. So it's a $2,500 per room. If they only hold four, it's $1,250. Twos are the same. Most twos rooms are set up for 16, but we do have some programs where it's an eight. So it's $2,500 or $1,250.
And this is $2,500 total or $2,500
per room?
Per room. Okay.
That have children. If it's a twos, threes mix, the way it works is we can only pay out on the 2 year old. We took $2,500 and divided it by 16, and that's $156 per child.
So basically, you're just supporting by giving the materials.
Or it's consumable, material. or the supplies.
Sense. Yep.
Yeah.
One-time money, right? Just one time.
Well, we have 2 year. Well, year and a half at least.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So some people might get it more than once
because they're getting re-rated
annually.
Mm-hmm.
So it's based on the rating.
Mm-hmm.
So possibly two.
Mm-hmm.
You have a question.
Oh, just want to clarify the timing for the support initiative.
If they're rated on or after January 1st, 2023. Did I say before on here?
No,
if I did?
After.
Okay.
After.
Yeah. On or after. So what that means is people that are being observed this month, their rating will go into effect on January 1st. So they will be eligible. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. And then, I don't remember what was in my brain. It went. It happens to me.
Yeah, that's like when I called you, Carolyn.
Yeah, no, it happens. It happens to me all the time. So there was something I was going to say, but now I don't remember what it was. So if I think of it, but I'm excited about any time that we get to be the good guys and give stuff to people, it just makes me happy. So I'm really excited about this, and I'm really appreciative of URPD for being willing to take this on, because it's a lot making all those orders for people. It's a lot of work. They're awesome. So. Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. Okay, so next up is Kathy Randall to update us on the stabilization grant.
I hope you guys are happy about the news that this is going to be extended.
So happy.
Let's put it that way.
We are still working on the details and how it will work, but you know, we do have time. That won't really affect until October, but hopefully we can start educating you guys. My hope is like March or April of next year, so that you have a few months to kind of get ready for that. So. This is just the current numbers that we have sent out. You can see I've added the CRSA funding that we talked about. So the ones on the CRSA program are those that were registered after March 11th of 2021 and commercial preschools. So you can see that it's quite a bit difference in the amount of money that we're spending, but at least we were able to open it up for a lot of new providers to open up those slots. This graph is just kind of the percentage of this information. So you can see our licensed family, they're the bulk of who receives the funds, and then centers. The bottom one is a very teeny tiny dark blue line over there. But they are captured there.
Kathy, these are by number of programs, right?
Correct.
Do you have a similar pie chart for amount of funds?
I do not have that yet. We are in the process of trying of getting other information. So you want to know how much money went to families and centers and stuff like that. We arrive and work on that for the next
time. That would be great.
We're also working on getting a report based on enrollment so we can track license from the beginning and how that increased and enrollment from the beginning to how that increased. And that's just all based on the self-declaration when you guys complete the monthly reports.
Yeah, I would love to see the children as well.
Yeah.
Like how many.
The enrollment, yeah.
We're really, we want that too. I don't know if someone will talk later, but we've had such a jump in slots, licensed slots, that child pricing is reporting. And I'm curious what that, how that correlates with increase in enrollment.
That's kind of all I have. Do you guys have any questions about that? Or I will work on the financials.
I think the feds need this.
They have it.
No, they need to look at it.
Closer.
And
usually, that stuff.
When do you anticipate
seeing those stories? Yeah. Well, we have a data team, and we want that report, but we have other things that have to be reported on that were time sensitive, and so it just keeps getting bumped down. I hope.
Next time. I am going to follow up tomorrow to see when that is. But yeah, we had some federal reports that we had to push out that took process over that.
I think one thing that's interesting, I'm joining with saying, like, we should share this with the feds. Just to let you all know, we have a monthly check-in meeting with our region program officers, and we report on this every month. We have a, really particularly around, like, stabilization grant, we probably have, like, a 20-question at least 20 questions that we have to report to every month about this type of data, how much you spent, what's the average, how many kids does that affect. So it's a ton of information that they are collecting. So they're seeing it.
They're just not hearing it.
They know. There was a White House report that got released a little while ago that talked about this exact issue, that these grants that are running out supported 200,000 providers nationwide. Like, Utah's definitely not unique. So I think, like, when we hear from national advocacy organizations, they're like, like everybody is kind of on top of it and thinking about how to work this into future agendas. Just not to say it's going to happen. I know I don't have to tell you that, Jody, but, like, I think there's a lot of understanding that there are going to be some real issues, or there could be.
Since it's my last day, can I just make a plug real quick to ask for a round of applause for Kathy and her team?
Yeah.
they are constantly providing technical assistance, responding to emails, and I think they are in some ways the unsung heroes of, like, behind the $170 million that has so far been spent. So thank you, Kathy, for your leadership and for your team.
We try really hard. I know sometimes we're getting bad news, but on our side, we are doing everything we could possibly think of to not give the bad news. Thanks.
Thank you. Yes, very much. So, Joellen!
So, Jeffrey, got you ready? You did not. I'm back. So one thing I remembered what I was going to say that flew out of my head. The family child care amount per child is $230. So it's a mix between, so we took the rate for infants and the rate for twos and met in the middle. Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay. So here is our data update for the CCQS. So this is the centers. So this is our current rating distribution, which includes all the programs that were observed in September, rated on October 1st. Wait, no, November 1st. Yeah, right, November 1st. So
So here is where we are. We have 110 out of 396 centers that have a current certified rating. So 27.7% of all the centers have been rated or are currently rated. So you can see the breakdown here of the percentages. So our largest percentage is foundation of quality and then building quality. We did start our coaching program. So we have 14 of those programs that apply for intensive coaching that we're now coaching to try to help them get to the quality mark by the next time they go through the process. So we have 21% are high quality and 3% are high quality plus. So, and then we also collect, so we look at what's happened over the last 12 months. So to see, because this is what we report to the feds. So we tell them what we're measuring here, how many programs out of the number that are rated hit, you know, increase their observation score, which what that means is their observation point score. There's no way we can look at each individual observation. And that, so how many of programs actually improved from the last time, So as you can see, we've actually seen the biggest increase in the SAPQA observation scores. 64% of the programs are able to hit the high quality threshold with the SAPQA. And there's been a lot of really good work done by UAN to help programs understand the tool. We did add an additional after-school person that focuses on CCQS. They have also started intensive coaching in some programs. But so that's where we're seeing the biggest increase. I think the least is 20% in education of caregivers. And my assumption, and owners could probably say, is just the turnover right now is probably affecting that percentage. So yeah, but we are seeing gains in many, many programs. Montana, can you go? Next, we have family child care. So we're still in the early rating. So these are the folks that had applied on the temporary that then decided to apply for a rating using the standard framework. And we did open the regular framework on November 1st. So now any family child care provider can apply within the system. So we now have the system open. We're really happy about that. And we are getting applications. We have had some applications come in since the 1st. But this group is just those people that were on the temporary framework. So we currently have 55 family child care providers rated out of 836, so that is 6.6%. So I think we have some work to do. But family child care really knocked it out of the park. I really have to give kudos to them. We, in some ways, I think the pandemic may have helped because we had to find other ways to support providers during the pandemic. So they had a lot more stuff in advance to help prepare them. We had the PLCs and some of the other stuff where the centers didn't have that advantage during their early rating period. But we actually have 20 out of the 55 that rated high quality, so 36%. The ironic thing is we have 28 buildings. Out of that 28 buildings, 13 of them got the high quality score on the tool. They just didn't have the point on the framework. So 33 out of, I think, 66 that applied originally, 50% actually hit the threshold on the observation piece. That's amazing. That's incredible. That's really amazing. So the current data, we don't have the same data because we don't have some of the preliminary, but the data we do have from the temporary framework shows that 53% of the primary caregivers, so usually that's the licensee, increased their points for caregiver education.
and 91% increased the total points on the framework. And increased the certified rating 67%. So they've been really motivated, and we have a few more that will be rated this month. We have a couple observations this month, but then in January we'll begin, anybody that applies this month, their observations will be in January. That's all I got. Any questions? Now I really am going to sit down for the rest of the time.
Okay. Thanks, Joellen. So next is Heather Thomas with our professional development update.
We have a couple updates on, we presented on this last time, but now it's actually going into effect. So the our stimulus-funded scholarships, the early education payback program for college degrees, our career ladder college course scholarship, and our conference registration scholarship, we are expanding that eligibility. That is now open starting this month. So like we had before, you need to work at least 15 hours a week in a paid in a program. All the licensed programs are eligible, and then we've now added the other programs that were eligible for the Youth and Early Care Workforce Bonus. So the DWS approved exempt centers, exempt out of school time, and the family, friend, and neighbor programs. So we're just trying to spend out more of that money and provide this opportunity for more people. So we're excited to open that up and expand it. And then we're making, there's an upcoming policy change for our professional development incentive. We had a line in there that said that you needed to be continuously employed for 12 months prior to your application date to start receiving those incentives for your career ladder levels. And we are removing that piece. We have changed those incentives to where when you complete the hours on the level, that's when you can achieve it. And so it makes sense that if someone wants to start working on their level one and get their hours in, then whenever they complete that, those requirements, that they can receive it and they don't have to wait 12 months to actually get that first incentive. So we are removing that requirement, and then we're still keeping that they must be currently employed for at least 20 hours a week at a DWS eligible license program. So that's our change there that's upcoming. It should be going into policy soon. As far as curriculum updates, I spoke about these two courses last time as upcoming. They're now available for career ladder levels 2 and 3. We have our Care About Child Care courses on the infant and toddler ages and stages. That's a 10-hour course, and the preschool and school age ages and stages piece. And those are both scheduled for January. Those are out and available to everyone to take. And then an upcoming revision for Career Ladder Level 1 is our Healthy Care course. We have removed a lot of the information in there that was specific to child care licensing rules, because those things are covered by child care licensing and their training, and are addressing health and wellness topics more generally for both the children in programs as well as the teacher and the caregiver. So felt like that was important to address the caregiver, the educator, and their care for themselves, as well as then being able to care for the children. So we're really excited about that one coming up. And that's it for me. Any questions?
Yeah. What is the funding used for? Is this COVID funding for the early education feedback program?
Yes.
It was COVID funding.
Yes. Those three that we expanded eligibility for, yes, those are currently funded by the CRSA funding. We are planning to extend those into the ARPA discretionary funding for an additional year.
So it will be
through September of 2024. And like other people have said, we'll be looking at our regular budget and looking at the outcomes from some of these programs to see whether we can extend some of these further as we go into our normal funding.
And it'll really help with retention. Yeah, really.
Have you seen increase of this? People taking advantage of the reimbursement portion for the college degree?
We've seen some. We haven't seen as much as we wanted. We are not spending out all the money, which is why we wanted to expand it out to offer it to other people.
yes, there are some people taking advantage of it. We're working on developing some more marketing and outreach materials to try to reach people. We've done some targeted outreach over social media and optimization for Google searches and that kind of thing. We do have some increase, but we would like more people to participate. So,
just a plug for the professional development. I think in our state, it's gone up so much in the last, I would say, 3 to 5 years. It's amazing. So I think you guys are doing a great job at revamping our courses too, which is really
great. Cool. Thank
people
you.
Aren't getting that same courses. They can
right.
go in now and
something new.
They're seeing something different, so they're willing to take those courses a more than they were. So good job.
Thanks for the feedback.
I have one question.
Sure.
Are we offering these courses in Spanish?
Yes, we are. All our new courses that we are revising, we are also translating into Spanish. And I know many of the Care About Child Cares offer those courses in Spanish as well. And if you go into our course calendar, you can see if they're marked it as Spanish.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you, Heather. And next up is Anne with our subsidy update.
Everybody. So I couldn't be here last month either. I had a conflict, and I understand that Lisa Roma gave my update for me. And the last two data points on the data trends, there were some questions about. So I wanted to come back and just share those two data points again with some further detail. So the first one was in state fiscal year 22, $106 million was spent on subsidy. This is an increase of $39.5 million since 2019. So the question was, what does that include exactly? So I put the breakdown here so you can see exactly where those figures are coming from. So it does include just regular CCDF, our TANF funds. We have a small group of families that receive childcare through TANF, so that was included. And then our COVID funding. So $8.6 million in COVID is included in that $106 million total. And then the last bullet point was the average monthly subsidy per child is $674 per month today, compared to $445 in 2019. So there's some questions about that, those figures as well. So that's just simply an average based on the total subsidy expended, divided by the total number of children served, and then divided by 12 months. So, of course, we can look at different provider types and age groups, and those numbers will fluctuate. It's just a blanket figure across the board. So any questions on those clarifications? Okay, then the next slide. Rebecca mentioned at the beginning when she was talking about the ARPA discretionary funds that we were going to fund some training, customers in training with who need child care. And so I'm just going to give a little bit more in-depth summary of that. So those families that are enrolled in a WIOA or TANF non-step funded program through Workforce Services can qualify now for childcare without having to meet that 15-hour minimum work requirement. So that's going to be effective February 1st. And they'll just apply and we'll be able to identify, we're updating the application so that we can identify those funding streams. And then also we're coordinating with the Workforce Development Division who's approving the training funds so that they can notify eligibility of those customers and that they're in need of childcare so that we can work together between those two divisions. Again, this is with ARPA discretionary. Our funding needs to be obligated by September 30th of 2023. So any customers from February to September will remain eligible for an additional year through September 2024. So we'll have to be monitoring and tracking this. We would like to make it permanent with CCDF funds long term. So it just depends on how many customers apply. Any questions on that? Okay, that's all that I had today.
Great, thank you, Anne. Okay, so next on to our agency updates. Teresa, Simone, do you have anything for us?
finally, Jared's going to, like, not have to rush through his own
table. I'm so excited for him. The rest of his time is yours. There you go.
Okay, wow. I can talk slowly.
Just spread it out, Jared. You have 45 minutes today. You've earned it, my friend.
You go from like 2 minutes to 45. I've had short questions for years.
Okay. All right, we'll see what we can do. First off here, okay, there is an update that I got after I made these slides, and so this is not on the slides, and I'll send the information to you, Montana, too, to include in the minutes here, from CACFP. As many of you may know, CACFP started their federal program year, last month. Now we're in November, so it was last month in October. It goes from October 2022 to September 2023, which means that they are starting their CACFP administrative reviews for the sponsored programs. And so those programs who will be receiving the reviews coming up have been contacted, but just keep in mind that those are, you know, since we are in a new federal year, those are beginning. The second update from CACFP is that they now have their training calendar for the year developed. The first training will be on December 14th. It's the Power Hour focused on income eligibility forms and enrollment. This will be virtual. It'll be from 10:30 to 11:30, once again, online. There is a Eventbrite, way to sign up for it that I will also include in the information I sent to Montana to go out with the meetings. The other trainings will be, the next one will be March 1st, and that will be meal patterns and infant meal patterns, also virtual. Then April 26th on healthier CACFP and farm to ECE, which I'll be mentioning a little bit more in a moment. Then, and all of these power hours are from 10:30 to 11:30 online. May 4th, there will be an in-person training for CACFP. That will be at the USBE building in Basement West, and that will be from 8:30 a.m. to 3 p.m. Focus is on basic training, administrative, and operational aspects of CACFP. Then the final power hour scheduled will be next July, July 19th. That will be about annual contract renewals, since the contracts do have the October through September year. So watch for that information included in the minutes. With that, I mentioned that there's the healthier CACFP and the farm to early childhood education trainings in April. Hannah Wally from USBE wanted me to let you all know about the opportunities with healthier CACFP and the farm to early childhood education initiative. They're encouraging all sponsors to explore these programs and how you can use them to enhance the CACFP program and the funding that you receive. Kind of some exciting opportunities for, you know, kind of the, you know, accessing food from local farms or local programs. If there are any questions, please do contact Hannah Wally. I'll include her email address in the information too, but just really briefly, it's Hannah, H-A-N-N-A-H dot Wally, W-A-L-L-Y, just two L's there, at schools.utah.gov. So that's the CACFP side. There are no new updates from the after-school program. Those people, or those programs who are working with the 21st Century grants, we're in the process of hiring a new administrator for that. There's some staff turnover. We'll be hiring, that should be hired in the next 2 to 4 weeks. So that's only those people who are involved in the 21st Century grant program. So that's on that side. As far as preschool updates, this is a reminder. I talked about it briefly last time. It's up and available now. USBE has developed some parent guides to help support parents in supporting their children's home learning based on the early learning standards. There's the link up there on the slide. Basically, we have them developed from preschool up through high school. We have two separate parent guides for 3-year-olds and 4-year-olds to help parents to support their children's learning. Please do encourage your staff when you have, you know, family engagement events. help connect families with this information so they can help support the children who are ages 3 and 4 in at-home learning. Okay, go ahead, next slide, please. A related thing, I guess I also mentioned this last time too, the Early Learning Hub through the UAN website is now available. This has a repository of information for early childhood educators and administrators. It's a kind of a nice one-stop shop that has information and links to trainings through USDE, as well as links to information through PBS Kids, a variety of other resources. There are a variety of other trainings and other resources available to programs, teachers, families at that site. Some new information here. We are in the process of beginning to do some curriculum reviews. We want to, in a similar process to what we have with the K through 12 learning materials, we're in the process of contracting out for reviewers to go through early childhood curricula and learning materials to evaluate. And basically what we'll be doing is we will be compiling from these reviews a list of USDE approved materials, curriculum materials, and then extra support materials for programs to use. If anyone has information or has recommendations for what curricula or what supplemental materials we should review, please send them my way. We'll also be recruiting outside reviewers to help with this process, because the process usually is we contract with outside reviewers to go through the materials, rate it according to a rubric on things like developmentally appropriate practice, ease of use, cost, other items. If you're interested in serving as a reviewer, please contact me there too. Finally, we have a pilot program, a pilot partnership that we're doing with the Upstart program this year. The idea is that we're really hoping that classroom teachers can be able to access information about children's learning from their home learning through Upstart, to use that as one of their, basically a formative assessment to help then use information about where the child is in their academic learning to create more developmentally appropriate learning activities in the classroom based on knowledge of where the children are from Upstart. Kind of an interesting partnership there that, the learning at home can help support teachers in developing and planning for learning in the classroom. We started off with this just being a very small pilot because the logistics involved with it, but Upstart's IT department was able to develop a way that teachers can basically create a login that they can enroll their students in a roster and then basically enroll log in directly to the children's Upstart information to access that. And so we're able to expand this program to basically any program that would be interested in participating. If you are interested in participating in the program, you can either contact me and I will connect you with some resources, or connect directly with Audrey Blank at Upstart, and her email address is here in the slides, audreyblank@waterford.org. And I still have, half an hour, and that's all of my So, Rebecca, you said you had a ton of questions.
No, I don't appreciate you.
Okay, any questions at all about any of these? Oh, that's the information from Upstart about this pilot program.
Do you have to be a licensed childcare provider to participate in this?
No. Basically, anyone who works with children who are enrolled in Upstart. Upstart would really like to, especially since they need to finish their enrollment for the year. I think there's about a week to go, maybe a week and a half. It's basically right before Thanksgiving that they need to finalize. They're really hoping that programs, any, licensed, family, wherever, who would be interested in participating in this pilot can encourage the children in their programs, or the families of children in their programs, to enroll the child in Upstart so that they can help create that connection so that teachers can have access to the children's learning through Upstart to, as I was mentioning, develop more developmentally appropriate learning in the classrooms based on basically the formative data that they get from Upstart. So yeah, anybody's available, anybody's have access to that.
I have a question.
Yes.
Kind of related to this, because you talked about how this the data on those kids will be used to kind of help formulate some of what they're doing. Are they also going to be using data from ASQ information as part of this developmental screening project statewide? I assume some of them will be having the families do the ASQ 3 and SE, and will that be then embedded as well as the data from Upstart?
Yes and no. It would be separate from this, but a lot of programs are using the ASQ as a screener for their program, and you know, since they are using it within the program, they would have that access to use in informing instruction in the classroom, especially as a screening tool to help identify potential special needs within children. So yes, it's separate from this, but yes, that's something that a lot of programs are using just on a program level, using ASQ to assess development and identify any needs there.
Thanks, Jerry.
Any other questions?
Wow. Okay, so this is the time that we ask for if there's any other business from the committee, if anything that there's out there that anybody wants to bring up, or...
I think we're ending early because I haven't been feeling well, so I've been talking a lot.
Or good to you.
Just on the record.
You want to admit it. Is there any public comment? I was almost afraid to ask. I never know. I hope somebody... No? My staff's not even expecting me back for 45 minutes.
Don't
try to make a motion. Please. We have a motion to end. A second?
Second.
This is everybody's work first bonus.
Well, and because this is it for the rest of the year.
Oh.
We don't meet again until January.
We're not doing like a Secret Santa or anything?
That's a great idea.
No, no.
Are you kidding? I just canceled that for a reason.
Oh, we are.
Okay. So one of us could bell.
Yeah. Oh. All right. Everyone, thank you.
Sure. So email me. Sam won't have her email after.